Yeah, a bit of Hey Cow by Aaron Harris and his farm band. And I would like to welcome Chance Cutaro in the studio. Hi, Chance.
Good evening again. Thank you.
Indeed. And you are with the Resource Renewal Institute. Can you tell us a bit about the Resource Renewal Institute?
Sure, absolutely. So the Resource Renewal Institute, we call it RRI, is an environmental nonprofit organization located in Mill Valley, California, just south of here. Could be 30 or 40 minutes, but with traffic, it's right. A bit longer. The organization's mission is essentially to foster innovative solutions for like increasingly complex environmental problems that we're facing today, climate change and whatnot, and to really test new ideas. We think of ourselves like a think and do tank. So not only do we come up with policy solutions and advocate for solutions, but we're also testing things out and spinning out ideas that end up becoming new organizations or programs that other nonprofits carry forth.
Creative.
It's very creative, and it's all really centered around natural resource management solutions and things like that. And it's been around over 30 years now and does a wide variety of advocacy, education, organizational development, analysis, applied research, everything like that.
Well, where does the funding come from?
Yeah, so we're very fortunate that the founder of RRI, his name is Huey Johnson. He's one of these environmental titans, not only of California and the Bay Area, but really nationally, a very significant person in the movement. And he founded the Trust for Public Land and also basically built up the Nature Conservancy. He was the eighth employee, first employee west of the Mississippi. After years of working in land conservation, land saving, he was tapped by Jerry Brown during his first administration back in 77 to become Secretary of Resources for the state of California. That was the real time to,
oh my God,
to be the Secretary of Resources, to dig into renewable energy, to work on all kinds of innovative solutions for reforestation and protection of wild and scenic rivers and the like. So,
oh, I was here then. It was a wonderful time. It was burgeoning.
Yeah, absolutely. And when he came out and founded the Resource Renewal Institute, all of these fantastic philanthropists who were so pleased with the work he did in Sacramento built these relationships with him when he founded Resource Renewal Institute. And so over the years, he's maintained these strong relationships. And we pride ourselves on being pretty lean. There are really three full-time employees that sort of run the ship with a variety of consultants that come in and out and do little projects with us. Meager budget, but we like to think that we have this really big impact, and we look like we're much larger than we actually are.
Oh, that's always the key, yeah. So what type of other projects are you involved with apart from Point Reyes?
Yeah, so one of our flagship projects right now is sort of a inventive land and water management solution to rice farming in the Central Valley, in the Sacramento Valley, north of Sacramento. And it's called Fish in the Fields. It's basically a integrated agricultural land use system with massive implications for methane mitigation, for maintaining our temporary wetlands. Essentially, what we're doing is in the winter months, those rice fields are flooded and fallowed.
Right.
And that is a temporary wetland for migratory waterfowl as well as shorebirds.
Right.
And so Huey was sitting in a duck blind one time, as he does, and he thought, wow, there must be another valuable use for these flooded ponds. What if we grew fish? And so we set off on a project to do salmon restoration by putting salmon fingerlings in these rice fields, essentially in these former floodplain ecosystems before we diked and dammed everything. And what he had found was that these fish grow much fatter and much healthier in these floodplain ecosystems where there's a lot of rich food, right, zooplankton. And so now Cal Trout runs that program, and we've been doing Fish in the Fields, which is essentially doing that on the commercial side. So giving rice farmers a second cash crop in the winter months, they're able to grow fish. And our hope is that at scale, this project can offset and alleviate some of the intensive forage fish fishing in the oceans. And we've also found that it really completes this whole loop in the rice field ecosystem. It's just such an environmental crop. So it's really finding a missing link.
Yeah, I remember, yeah, exactly. I remember when they used to burn it, burn all the rice crops out there. It was awful when it used to come here.
Yeah, and so in the 90s, they switched it up and allowed suggested flooding. And so now it creates a whole new world of potential benefits utilizing these flooded fields.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
That's a simple solution.
Yep. And it's just one example of the type of projects we do. Another one is, he was in the land trust business. And so he realized there was a gap in the type of NGOs that are protecting the greater Grand Canyon ecosystem. And so he, using the work that he had done with the Trust for Public Land and Nature Conservancy, decided to come up with the Grand Canyon Trust. Mm-hmm. And now that's its own separate, spun out, massive nonprofit that protects not just the Grand Canyon itself, but that greater ecosystem and the wildlife and in the watershed. So it's a lot of successful projects like that that try to think beyond just the little pieces of each parcel of land and things like that.
Right. Obviously, yeah, it's got to be holistic.
Yep. Systemic. Exactly. Yeah.
That's the beauty of it, is that individuals can make a difference, a huge difference in our world.
Yeah.
Somebody has that passion to move things.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an honor to call him a mentor and a friend. And he does a fantastic job creating space and allowing others to sort of rise up and take space and learn and grow. So.
Oh, that's very special. Congratulations on that environment.
Yeah, it's a great organization to work with. Yeah.
You've been working on, obviously, Point Reyes Park for a while now. So maybe give a bit of background about Point Reyes, when it came into, what is it, and when it came into being and the fight since then.
Sure. So a quick recap of Point Reyes. Geologically speaking, it's actually not part of the San Francisco Bay Area. It's on the other side of the San Andreas Fault. And so it's this island that's been moving up the coast over tens and hundreds of thousands of years down from LA. And so back in the 1930s, the National Park Service actually sent geologists out here. And they did a plan in 1935 where they said, just based on geologic exploration, scientific research alone, this peninsula is so special, it's worth considering preservation. And then, years later...
At the time, what was it in that area? Just farms?
At the time, it was farms, okay. Yeah. And so since the coastal Miwok were essentially pushed out of the area by immigrants and newcomers, it's been an agricultural production for the most part. It's shifted hands quite a few times. There were Italian immigrants that were out there, and there were also lawyers that ended up getting hold of the land, and they broke it up into a bunch of different parcels with different letters of the alphabet. And over time, they allowed different people to lease it, and it was in different hands. So most of Marin County was kind of like country houses for the wealthy landed people in San Francisco. Right. And so these beautiful bucolic farmland agrarian areas were often leased by immigrants who had the skill and the know-how to work the land. It essentially was like that for about a century, up until the National Park Service gave Point Reyes a second look. They were trying to establish a national seashore actually north of here in Oregon, and they lost the battle to do so. And, there's a national seashore on the East Coast, Cape Cod, as well as now Fire Island. And then there's only one national seashore on the West Coast, which is Point Reyes National Seashore. And so it was the work of great conservationists and politicians like Clem Miller and Philip Burton and Secretary Udall, and also people like Carolyn Livermore and Huey Johnson and David Brower in the Sierra Club played a very big role. And Huey actually was involved in Point Reyes. He actually purchased pieces of Point Reyes. So some of the ranches that are still ranch today, he acquired them from RCA Corporation back in the 70s. He, as part of the Trust for Public Land, sold them to the National Park Service to help complete the plan for Point Reyes. And it, you know, is contentious for at least, you know, 5 to 10 years, how they were going to actually complete the development of Point. They knew they want, it's like a perfect peninsula. So you, if you can get all of it, it would be fantastic for a park and so close to a major metropolitan area. But the difficult thing was that there were these ranches, and so they could purchase the beaches all around, but how to deal with the ranches in the middle was one of the complicated things. And so they came up with this, originally this donut model, where the ranches would stay in the middle in private hands because they wouldn't sell. And on the exterior, they would have parks, state parks and federal parks.
And that was, and when did that, that decision occur?
So that actually was in discussion about 62, and that's when the park was, they were first, Clem Miller was a congressman in Marin County, Marin Sonoma, and big idea to sell this as a national seashore and try to raise the money at the time. I mean, it was over $14 million, and in those dollars, it was a lot more. He flying back and forth, and so was the Marin County Board of Supervisors, as well as the ranchers. They were going to Congress and lobbying against the National Seashore. And they decided to establish a state park there and open a beach for the public. But naturally, the people in West Marin, like the people in a lot of agrarian sort of communities, are worried about sprawl, worried about development. And so there was this fear of development pressure and the fear of essentially, I guess, land appraisals and land values going through the roof and taxes going up and things like that.
Right.
And so that actually led to some of that pressure to either purchase the land, raise the money in Congress to purchase the land, or for ranchers and people who were really in these low margin jobs, low margin businesses, like a lot of agricultural businesses, to sell out to the National Park Service. And so instead of that donut model, that what ended up occurring over the next decade between 62 and 72 was that all of the monies were raised, over $55 million were raised in order to buy out all of the ranchers. And so the entirety of that Point Reyes peninsula, all the way down to, so there are still inholdings today, town of Inverness, it's unincorporated part of Marin County, as well as Bolinas. Those are still on the Point Reyes Peninsula, but virtually everything, including all of the ranches, were acquired by the National Park Service for the purpose of Point Reyes National Seashore.
So they were purchased, but then how comes there are farms and cattle and things like that on the land?
For those unfamiliar with Point Reyes, there are still about 24 families that still farm and ranch out at Point Reyes National Seashore. And one piece of this was part of the purchase agreement. So they had these two different ways of doing it. One was a 25-year runway, essentially, where, you know, they purchase this parcel and these folks have 25 years or the life of them and their spouse. They can create these different agreements in order to essentially stay on the land. The Park Service did not want to use eminent domain. They didn't want to take this from anyone. Okay. They wanted to create an amicable agreement. There were actually Park Service employees that went to Sacramento and met with the Food and Agricultural Department and said, like, how important are these ranches to basically California agriculture, just because they were unsure of what the blowback is or what the downsides are of purchasing all of these ranches. And eventually through attrition and just retirement, like, what would that do to the economy at the state level, at the county level, et cetera. That was what had originally happened when they made these purchases back in 72. Okay. And then later in the 70s, they started to agree to some of these lease back clauses. So 5-10 year lease back agreements, 5 years up until sort of rolling over for the better part of 40 years until the 21st century, the mid-2000s, when some of them switched over to these sort of 10-year lease agreements as well, I believe.
So there's a patchwork going on there.
Yep, and each of the families leased their own sort of parcel individually, and so they're all on these different schedules. There's some that still took that lifetime lease, and then there are some that sort of migrated into this new system that has these special use permits where they're able to rent for a period of time. And today, all of those have expired. And so we're currently in the middle of a planning process out there to determine what the future of the seashore should look like. And right now, all of those leases are sort of, they're in a holding period because they're waiting to see what the outcome of this planning process would be.
They're sort of non-conforming right now, I suppose.
Yeah, they're on these, they're called letters of authorization. So they're 1 year permits. Okay. And part of a recent lawsuit, which we can get into as well, there was an agreement, a settlement agreement that allowed them to have from, I believe, July of 2017, they had 5 years, essentially. There doesn't have to be the bureaucracy of doing these 1 year leases every year while this planning process plays out. There's sort of like a ad hoc thing where just blanket 5 years, everyone, don't worry about, you know, these annual leases. Okay. And then at the end, when that all that is settled, there's a record of decision about what the future plan will be for managing the seashore. Then they'll determine what happens with the leases. It's a lot. Yeah, it is. The story of Point Reyes is complex. And I've probably gone through, I don't know, maybe 4,000 or 5,000 pages of both government documents, historic records, the books that everyone writes about it, because it is this beautiful bucolic place at times. It's amazing wildlife. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's this bioreserve, part of the Golden Gate Bioreserve, is one of the most biodiverse places in the world. So it's the only marine wilderness on the West Coast, I believe, Drake's Bay. And that was a contentious issue as well with removing an oyster farm. So,
of course. Yeah.
It's a special place and a lot of people care about it. And so there's a lot of fireworks, and I think it has a lot to do with like the passion that everybody has about the place.
Right. And obviously, I suppose not much has been able to be done, obviously, on the farming areas, but the other areas that haven't been impacted by that, how were they rewilded? How was all that taken into account to make that a real living park?
The park is roughly 71,000 acres, and they also manage roughly 11,000 acres of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, in the northern part of Golden Gate National Recreation Area, which is, for those listening, it's in Marin County on the western side of Mount Tamalpais, closer to the Pacific Ocean. And there were ranches over there. The National Park Service purchased those ranches as well. Let's say that just looking at the Point Reyes Peninsula, the 71,000 acres, about 28,000 of those are still leased for cattle grazing. And that is what is considered currently the pastoral zone. And that's where this historic ranching district exists. Huh. South of this ranching zone and south of Drake's Bay is the Philburton Wilderness area. And that is about roughly 30,000 acres that has been rewilded. And so there's primitive camping, hiking camping, lots of beautiful beaches. It's more of a forested area. So the area that could be restored to basically a native coastal prairie is still used for the economic purpose of rangeland, cattle grazing. The other areas that were more forested, there were timber speculators over there. There used to be a copper mine in that part. Those areas have been rewilded and because those uses were deemed unacceptable in a national seashore.
Now, what was the original habitat like before we came and roughed the place up?
So there are some fantastic ecologists and experts on this, like Laura Cunningham. She's the California director of Western Watersheds Project. Mm-hmm. And she has a book on essentially what Native California used to look like before we came and killed everything, including all the Native people that were living here. So I don't mean to say that lightly at all, but she's the expert really on what things used to look like. Essentially what you'd see would be, say, from the Pacific Ocean, you'd have the beach, of course, which a lot of us enjoy living out here. And then you'd get to this coastal dune ecosystem. And that's also very beautiful, but there's sort of these tidal wetlands that come in there. It's great habitat for endangered snowy plover populations. You might see elephant seals in that ecosystem. And then just up from that, you'd have what was the native coastal prairie, which includes perennial grasses, in addition to coastal scrub, coyote brush, essentially habitat for a lot of the charismatic fauna that aren't like giant grizzly bears, but the bobcats, the foxes, the wolverines. You'd see that's where essentially the avian life, birds of prey, love, they exist in that ecosystem. So if you love hawks, if you love the eagles, if you love the peregrine falcons, you're going to find them in this coastal scrub ecosystem that has been eliminated in much of the pastoral zone in place of non-native grasses for cattle ranching. And so up from there, then you'd have, it kind of migrates into this Bishop Pine, Douglas fir ecosystem as you go up in elevation. And that is pretty much what the characteristic of the wilderness area of Point Reyes looks like. And some of the ridges that are still within the pastoral zone, you still get some of those trees that it's great spot to find owls as well. Yeah. So that's what that looks like. And then it kind of goes over that hill or that elevation and then down to the Tamales Bay, and you get sort of that estuary, and it's just a sharp decline.
There was a pretty big, serious fire about, 15, 20 years ago, I suppose, now out there. How has that rebounded and nature done its duty?
Yeah, I would say for humans, these wildfires are scary and life-threatening, and some can put, say, like catastrophic. For nature, there are other experts and forest ecologists that would say that this is how it works in the West, is these fires are used to essentially clear the underbrush and the understory to allow for more organic matter to get into the soils, to create richer soils and to allow for new trees to come up and things like that. And so it's sort of part of a natural cycle that many of us in the West have been removed from because of fire suppression tactics for the last century. But the landscape up there is restored, and it happens at a different time scale than we're accustomed to. But all through, there are prescribed burns in national parks, and really they actually allow like wildfires take place in places like Yellowstone and just run their course because it's part of the native ecology of that ecosystem.
Right.
And there used to be planned burns out there when the coastal miwok were out there as well. It was part, if you burn an area, it can flush wildlife game out of another area.
Right.
And also if you burn an area and it becomes some of these perennial native grasses come back there, then in a year or two, that's the place you're going to go back to go look for game because you've created this space. So fires played an interesting role throughout the history of Point Reyes for people and for the native environment.
You've got some pretty serious big animals that roam around out there, apart from the tule elk and mountain lions and bears and things. And with the cutting up of the land, how is the roaming and their actual territories, how do they handle that? Is it difficult, or does it have to be, or do you have to help them, basically?
Much of the pastoral zone is essentially, it's not for public recreation. It's not for the use and enjoyment of the American people who've purchased that land. Mm-hmm. Much of the pastoral zone is is set up for cows and for the agricultural industry. And
wait. There you go.
All right, I'm getting used to the bell now. Okay, perfect. Yeah, as I was saying, much of the pastoral zone is barbed wire fences. Mm. And so for cows and for the cattle ranchers, it's how it is. That's how you run the business. For the wildlife, especially tule elk, there are conflicts there. And so over the last decade or so, tule elk were reintroduced 40 years ago or so, the 70s. In 78, they were introduced to the northern point of Point Reyes National Seashore, and they're still behind a fence. They're behind an 8-foot fence to prevent them from grazing the grasses that cows graze.
Oh, dear.
those ones, there's a fence. They can't deal with that fence. They can try to escape from the entrance where the cars go, but other than that, they're not jumping over an 8-foot fence. The other free-ranging elk that have been translocated to other parts of Point Reyes, the wilderness area, primarily, and then they either hiked or swam across Drake's Bay, and now they reside in the pastoral zone. Those elk are constantly coming into contact with these barbed wire fences. There's plenty of documentation from the FOIA documents we received from the Park Service of ranchers complaining about broken fences and what is the liability of a cow getting out, as well as many natural wildlife photographers documenting elk with barbed wire tangled antlers and elk that have died with barbed wire that is essentially over time melded with their jaw or melded with their face as they try to get this stuff off of them, because none of these fences are wildlife friendly fences in Point Reyes National Seashore. That is one of the most dramatic, I think, examples. I don't know how the mountain lions deal with the fences. They're pretty sleuthy, so can't be sure. But I think the fences are a big problem for the elk and also for the public who drive along these roads and don't realize they could go. I mean, it's their land. They can they can open a gate, close a gate, and go walk through that land. But it's sort of unappealing when it's all lined with barbed wire.
Yeah, exactly. And I presume mountain lions aren't hunted or anything like that. Is there any control mechanisms for them? Or
no, they're not.
Okay,
they're not. Yeah. There, it's a real, it would be a real sight to see if you were able to see one, because they are pretty pretty good at staying hidden.
Right.
The bobcats, alternatively, you can go out there. There are some great photographers that take people on tours out there, and if you want to go see a bobcat in the wild, eating in the wild, or a wolverine in the wild, you can go to Point Reyes National Seashore and you can see that very easily. And that's one of the splendors of having such a biodiverse park. There are all of these different scenes taking place every single day, all throughout this national seashore.
Yeah, and then every time of the year it changes when different creatures are coming ashore or going by.
That's right. Right now we have the elephant seals. The males are first to come up to the beaches, and they'll be followed by the females. You know, last year they had to shut down parts of parking lots because the elephant seals took them over, you know. So it's a fantastic thing to see this time of year. And just a few months ago was the rut for the tule elk. And so through this fog, if you can imagine, you hear the coast just, you know, vaguely in the distance, it's like, and this fog in the morning, and you hear the bugle of a tule elk is really, it's spooky, but it takes you back to sort of this like almost, I don't know, primitive feeling, you know, like being really close to something wild.
Right. Yeah. And getting back to what it was, not just our controlled version of it.
That's right.
Well.
That's right. Yeah. That's part of the ethos of national parks and wild areas is, you know, creating places where nature can nature.
Right.
Instead of zoos, and you just go by and you take a photo and you say you were there, something like that.
Exactly. And I suppose that brings us to the whole lawsuit that's been going on for many years between the park service and the farmers there, ranchers. Can you give us a background on that little piece and how that has, you know, stumbled forward?
Yeah, so there are two distinct lawsuits that the listeners should know. There's one which would be the oyster farm that used to exist in what is now a marine wilderness area that has been restored and is in the middle of this fantastic restoration. That was a litigation that was in some ways actually tied to Koch brothers' money. And it was against the National Park Service for essentially retiring this lease permit. And they had made this person aware when they took over the lease that at the end of the 40 years, this lease was going to be up because they were going to turn it to a wilderness area. In the plans, it was a potential wilderness area. Okay. And then this person, who is still a rancher out there, continued to fight it. So that is over. The next litigation is actually litigation brought by my organization, Resource Renewal Institute, against the National Park Service. We did that in conjunction with the Center for Biological Diversity and Western Watersheds Project, which I mentioned earlier. And that was brought by Advocates for the West, which is a public interest law firm that specializes in Western lands preservation, conservation, particularly grazing issues. They deal with sage grouse and things like that, salmon issues, water conservation issues. And so that was brought in 2016, February of 2016. And that was the culmination of research that had been done for about a couple of years. In 2014, there was an announcement by the Park Service that half of the elk herd that was behind the enclosed 8-foot fence at the northern end of the park had suddenly died. And at the same time, the elk that were free ranging on a ranch that had been retired, that population had doubled. And so there was it was in the middle of the drought that was being experienced here in California, and people were wondering, is this a case of neglect, of mismanagement on behalf of the Park Service? Not a single cow went thirsty or died, and yet you lose half of the really rare Tule elk out there. The Tule elk are outnumbered 10 to 1 on that national seashore.
Wow.
There might be, 5,000 Tule elk in existence. They were brought back from basically the verge of extinction, and yet there are, probably 5 million cows in California alone. And so that really raised a red flag. And so I, in coordination with my team, investigated this issue, and we uncovered that the Tule elk was just the tip of an iceberg out there, and that the National Park Service, due to the political influence and the pressure of essentially big agriculture, was ramming through a planning process that did not allow the public to weigh in on whether or not there should be 20-year leases or expanded agriculture on the seashore. Essentially, they were creating a plan that said, do you want your 20-year leases with goats and chickens and artichokes, or do you want your 20-year leases with bed and breakfasts, goats and pigs? And so we said, wait a minute, if there are already issues with the elk and with the cattle out there and they're just eating grass, what's going to happen when you carte blanche give every rancher out there the right to raise chickens and artichokes and sheep? And what will that do for the coyotes, for the bobcats, for the foxes, for the weasels, for the gophers? We decided that, this planning process was illegal. And so we took the National Park Service, not the ranchers, but we took the National Park Service to federal court and said, this planning process is not in line with a variety of national environmental policies to protect these resources unimpaired for future generations. And ultimately, we had asked that they do an environmental impact statement, which is this, essentially, it's EIS. It's part of the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, which you might hear when people talk about public lands. But essentially, this impact statement had never been done ever at Point Reyes National Seashore on the impacts of cattle ranching on the seashore. And so we said, before you do any of this stuff, hold up, you're going to 20-year leases. They want to go back to 1850s baselines for what they can have out there on their ranches. We should be looking 50 years into the future, 100 years into the future, not 150 years right backwards, essentially. And so we asked for this environmental impact statement. We asked for a fair and proper planning process that allowed all alternatives to be considered, not simply whether you want your 20-year leases with chickens or if you want it with your with your bed and breakfast and slaughterhouse, but we said you should have a no dairying alternative that the public that you can analyze and the public can understand and assess and comment on. Right. And you should have one that completely shuts down agriculture and is focused completely on the restoration of that national seashore. And the public should be allowed to analyze it and assess it and weigh in on it. And that is ultimately what happened. That case was settled, and the Park Service ended up agreeing to doing everything we had asked for, a new general management plan, not a special ranch plan, and to do an environmental impact statement, and to do it in a timely fashion. We're in the middle of that process right now. They recently came out with their first draft environmental impact statement, draft general management plan, and the public was able to see this fall all of the different alternatives that they laid out and what the impacts were for each of those alternatives. And they were allowed to comment. There were roughly 8,000 comments. And the next round will be this final plan that they will present to the American people in the spring of 2020. And we'll all have the opportunity to comment on that one more time before they go with a final record of decision and a final plan for the next 10 to 20 years of management at Point Reyes.
Now, I believe there's six different types of alternates to this. So the EIR will basically whittle that down to the most appropriate politically or fiscally.
maybe neither. I know it's usually unfortunately it's politically. You'd hope that there would be an environmentally preferred alternative, but they try to balance all of the different stakeholders, and we'll come up with one preferred alternative eventually that they will move forward with. The alternatives, the first couple alternatives they came up with were very similar. One was a status quo, leave it as is. Okay. One was to offer the 20-year leases and some light diversification of ranching. Another one was retiring about 7,000 acres of the ranching and focusing on the historic district more. And then there were a couple others, including no dairying, as well as complete cessation of ranching. And it would eliminate it. There would be a sunset period of some sort.
So what is the timetable then for these decisions?
As I mentioned, there will be this new plan that comes out early spring. And then after that, it'll be the final record of decision sometime, possibly late 2020, maybe. They have until July of 2021, I believe, to complete this plan. So they have some time, but also it should be noted that there are all of these time requirements from the National Environmental Policy Act in order, like how long you have to actually do this plan. And under this current administration, a lot of these have been shrunk to streamline the planning, which also sort of eliminates the time that the public has to weigh in, to assess and to comment on it. And so it's great for those in the know. It's not so great for people that we're trying to make aware in other parts of California and other parts of the country, saying like this, you know, this is happening. This is your land. It does reside in West Marin, but it is a national seashore, and 2.5 million people come to visit it every year from around the country and around the world. So it becomes more difficult with these tighter timeframes to turn everything around. So I expect that something will be pretty much finalized in 2020.
So, yeah, because obviously you can't expect people just to shut the doors the day after type thing. There's obviously got to be a phase out of all the various usages.
Yeah, so whatever they go with, if they go with their preferred alternative, it would be, and by their, I'm referring to the National Park Service, okay. Their preferred alternative would be to give ranchers 20-year leases and to expand the uses of agriculture, so to actually allow for the chickens and the row crops and pigs and goats and sheep and whatnot out there.
So it's not like, say, the Presidio, which had to be self-sustaining. How is the budget work on the for that park?
I'm sure everyone on every side of every aisle will say that Point Reyes is underfunded. And what that results in, as far as environmental protection, true resource preservation, is a lack of enforcement of leases out there currently. And on the flip side, what that results in is the inability to spend a lot of time providing, I guess, the attention needed for other uses, whether it's building out interpretation for the indigenous communities out there, understanding of the coastal Miwok and Pomo and whatnot. There's that aspect of it. And they also do pay for damaged fences for the ranchers. They do pay for the building repairs for some of these historic barns because they're owned by the Park Service. They try to factor them into these heavily subsidized leases that these ranchers pay. So they might pay $12 per cow-calf pair on the seashore, whereas a rancher on private land might pay twice as much, might pay closer to $20, $21, $22.
Oh, wow.
So it is subsidized. They try to work all of their payments into the lease agreements, but it's an underfunded national seashore. So it's also, for anyone listening, if you're here in Marin or Sonoma or up the coast, you can reach out to Jared Huffman. And you can advocate for building the budget, or you can advocate for wildlife preservation, or you can advocate for whatever you believe is right for the future of Point Reyes. If you're outside of Northern California, you can also reach out to your representative and advocate for these things too, because they do keep tabs on that, and you never know who advocates for a little bit more money in some of these budgets.
Well, in all those comments you got, they got rather, almost 8,000. How was that weighted? What came through?
So we have yet to see the latest round of comments. They've not been released to the public yet. The last round was a little over 3,000 comments in a sort of comment period light, if you will. And overwhelmingly, you have folks advocating for the preservation of wildlife, the restoration of this ecosystem, the protection of water, protection of elk, and individual things like that. But it's not politically feasible for the Park Service to necessarily listen to that majority if there's still undue political pressure and if their hands are tied because they want to keep their budget and there are lobbyists that are meeting with our congressmen, meeting with the president and saying, you got to help out industry here. And so
who are the heavyweights on the lobbying side?
There are a couple lobbyists that have a little group out there. I think probably strongest advocate for the ranching community appears to be the same gentleman that sued the Park Service over the oyster farm. His name is Kevin Lunny. He recently was one of the four Western workers, people who worked the landscape, sort of that was invited by Donald Trump to sort of stand alongside Donald Trump and be paraded out and say, we're going to protect these people. They work hard on the landscape. And Kevin got to say, the federal government shut down my oyster farm. And President Trump is like, oh, that's terrible. That's terrible, Kevin. We're going to help you, Kevin. We're not going to. He said it was actually worse. It was so typical of Donald. And he said, it was like, At least they're not as hard on you as they were on me. He like always, you know, turns it in on himself. So he did a whole tour of, he met with Donald Trump and he met with the Department of the Interior. And so
there's a thumb on the scale there.
A bit. It feels like that at times. And it's certainly Resource Renewal Institute. This is actually up until recently, it was not funded as a project. We received funding to do outreach about the comment period. And other than that, a lot of this work, unfortunately, falls on me to do sort of volunteer work outside or sort of this pro bono advocacy, because the wildlife don't have advocates. Mm. And so all of these other actors, whether it's people at the Board of Supervisors in Marin that have a vested interest in supporting economic activity, or in their unincorporated parts of Marin County, the ranchers are making money out there and they're living out there and they're paying super discounted rates to have thousands of acres of coastal frontage property where they can make money and not really worry about the environmental impacts, because the Park Service doesn't have any money to even enforce the leases that would prevent the negative impacts. But you have all of these groups that are sort of vying for position because they have a vested interest, an economic interest. And the environmental groups are just saying, like, why don't you just like stop the cows pooping in the water, like protect the salmon and like stop killing elk so that people can have people in like the Central Valley can eat burgers from a national park. I think that it's important to keep that perspective too, because difficult to keep up the fight and keep the motivation to, it's not even a fight against ranchers. It's not a fight against the Park Service. It's really a fight to protect wildlife and to protect that native ecosystem, and to ensure that, as is written in the statutes, in the enabling legislation for the National Seashore, in the enabling legislation for the National Park Service, that you leave these places unimpaired for future generations. It's a fight for something, not a fight against anyone.
Yeah, that pressure. It's tough, isn't it? It's tough to fight against.
Yeah.
Chance, we've beaten the clock. Thanks so much for coming in, Chance Cutrano of the Resource Renewal Institute. Now, how can people get hold of you and the Institute to find out more?
Yeah, so there are two ways. One is to go to rri.org, which is the Resource Renewal Institute website. The other would be to go to the actual program where you can learn more facts. You can get public studies that we've acquired from the National Park Service and sort of put in one place, so you don't have to go search 10 encyclopedias, 3 libraries, and 2 websites. And that's called restorepointraiseseashore.org. And it's essentially all about what this place could look like if we restored it. Not necessarily tomorrow, but really giving people a vision of hope to understand with climate change and with all of the impacts on wildlife around the country and around the world, if this is a reserve for wildlife and for the public to really see, as you said earlier, what happens when nature is allowed to nature, that's what we're trying to provide, is that that look is like, you know, cow, the number one greenhouse gas emitting thing in that national seashore are cows. In an era of climate change, should we be expanding and extending methane emitting animals in a national park at the expense of wildlife? So it's some of those things. So yeah, restorepointraiseseashore.org and rri.org are fantastic ways to get a hold of me. Or you type in Resource Renewal Institute on your search engine of choice, and I'm sure we'll pop up.
Beautiful. Well, great. I love your passion for it. And of course, it's a great need. It's such a large space. And as you say, it's totally unique. And we do need to look after it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you and the cows. That's so funny. I thank you for the opportunity to come here and talk about it. And I hope as this continues, we can keep in touch and continue to stay on the issue, because it's important. Definitely. For all of us.
Absolutely. Very, very important. It's diminishing all the time. So our spaces.
As is much of the environment, unfortunately. Yeah. But we're here.
Indeed. Thank you, Charles. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Arnold.
Okay.